First of all, thanks to all of you who've been in touch to say how moved you were by Hans Neumann's story that we covered in our episode with Ariana Neumann the other day about the book When Time Stopped. It was a real privilege to talk about him with his daughter. All of your messages are really appreciated. But on to today's episode. This time we're at Lady Margaret Hall, Oxford, for episode 17 of season 2 of Travels Through Time. I'm Peter Moore. Today we're embarking on a train journey of sorts. We're going back to the year 1876. We're going to be catching glimpses of Leo Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. And we're going to be looking at an intriguing journalist, lecturer and telephone pioneer called Kate Field. Most of all, we're going to be exploring the fluid in-between worlds, between fact and fiction. We have a variation on a theme for this episode, which is our Valentine's Day special edition of Travels Through Time. We're going beyond the hackneyed clichés of red roses and elegant candlelight, and instead we're heading back into a past that blurs realities, while posing the question, where do our favourite fictional characters come from? Here to explain what I'm talking about is today's guest. Dr. Sophie Ratcliffe is an associate professor at the University of Oxford, where she teaches English and is a fellow of Lady Margaret Hall. Her first book, On Sympathy, saw her engaging with ideas of emotion, the history of how we feel. Since then, she's edited the authorised version of P.G. Wodehouse's Letters, which I imagine must have been a tremendous job, and she's judged the Bailey Gifford Prize. Today, we're going to be talking to her about the people, ideas and historical period that give life to her latest book, The Lost Properties of Love. The Lost Properties of Love is an often funny and equally moving fragmentary mix of memoir literary history and imagined worlds. Philippe Sands called it magnificent, glorious on the journeys of life, love and loss. I met up with Sophie a few days ago at her office in Oxford. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Welcome to Travels Through Time, Sophie.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Let's begin with you telling us a little bit about your book, because when I was writing my introduction earlier, I found it a little bit difficult to classify, so I thought you'd do the job better than I could.
Okay, well, I'm chuffed to be the Valentine's Day special, because the book's about love, but it's also about death. It's about trains, as you mentioned, and it's about me. So it is in part a memoir, but it's a memoir with a difference, because I wanted to try and write honestly about hidden things, hidden histories, and the things we hide from people, even those who are closest to us. And I wanted to do that without getting divorced or getting fired. So far, so good. And one of the things I wanted to be honest about was about grief. This is in part a grief memoir. It talks about the loss of my father, who died when I was 13. But it also talks about different sorts of other losses that happen, lost objects and the loss that can come, the loss of self through motherhood, and the losses that can come from living in time and space with other people. And so I do all this thinking about these different kinds of losses while I'm on a train journey from Hull to Oxford. So sort of brief encounter-ish, but with more sort of maternal stuff and fish fingers and Lego and things like that. But the other thing I wanted to be really honest about is I have lived much of my life through books. I wanted to be honest about the idea that imagination is part of our reality. So my story of love and death and trains is tied up with the story of two other people's love and death and trains. And so on the course of my journey, when I'm thinking about my life, we collide with two women. One was an American journalist who really lived, and her name was Kate Field. And the other was a Russian socialite who fictionally died, Anna Karenina. And so my story is intertwined with their stories. It's a bit like Russian dolls. I wanted to try and say something truthful, but also something about the sort of realities of how we experience time and life, and with some jokes, I hope.
It is a moving book. I've read it over the last week, and you deal with really serious issues in your own life, but more broadly still.
Mm.
But it's very funny as well. I mean, there's some parts where you... there's a wonderful manifesto against going for walks in the countryside, which I really liked.
Yeah, my editor, Arabella, loves nature, so that she wrote in the margins, it's not all that bad, Sophie, but yeah.
This idea, because we're writers, we have to, you know, go and stare at butterflies for hours and be transported into some sublime other reality. That was interesting. And this playfulness of... your life, I suppose, growing up in Metroland, suburbia, and you say all suburban semis are alike, but each suburban semi is alike in its own way.
Oh, it's riffing off the opening line of Anna Karenina.
And of course, life in suburbia is an Argus catalogue of alternative possibilities. That made me really laugh as well.
Did you grow up in suburbia?
No, I didn't. I grew up in the countryside, but I suppose suburbia for me was an aspiration. So you took me inside the Argus catalogue.
Yeah. I think what I was searching to do was I wrote it at a time in life when my children were very little and I was very much confined by my research field, which was the stuff around me, the kitchen table, the toaster, the, oh goodness, what's for dinner? And I became more and more interested in questions of hidden histories, invisible labour. That's true to that experience and that lived experience.
Yeah, and it's a theme which, again and again, you come back to in the book, which is the nature of time and how it can stretch or it can compress. And time isn't equal, even though the one element of time, its central characteristic is it should be equal. Sometimes it's not.
Mm.
And you've gone for the year 1876.
1876 is kind of approaching the time of, we've got the telephone, the brink of the emergence of telephone. I love the kind of new technologies emerging. So yeah, this is something that really, that's sometimes often where I find myself landing.
Tell us about 1876. What was going on? What kind of world was it that we're about to travel back to now?
This is not why I chose 1876. So after choosing 1876, I had the fun of trying to find out, okay, what specifically was happening in 1876. It is the 100th anniversary of America's foundation. We have a crisis brewing in the Balkans, which was going to become the Russo-Turkish War. The year Eliot's Daniel Deronda was published, a novel I love, and this stuff, this kind of stuff I really like. It's the year that Heinz ketchup arrived on the market.
Oh, that's one of those little details. Maybe it's a Tolstoy kind of detail. Maybe he likes something like that too.
Tolstoy would not have approved of ketchup.
Do we have that on authority?
Well, he didn't like trains and he didn't like gramophones, so I would have thought those sorts of condiments would
have been frowned upon.
He's
got a wonderful quote about trains. I've got it down here somewhere. He hated trains. The railroad is to travel what a whore is to love. He wrote to friends. Yeah. So maybe the same principle applied to ketchup.
Yes.
We're going to do something really interesting, though, today, aren't we? Which is take leave of what we might term the historical world and go for your first scene into a fictional reality. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, when I asked whether I could do this, I didn't know whether it was sort of like
breaking
the rules in Desert Island Discs. But so the first scene I want to take you and our listeners to is a fictional historical rather than a real happening, but it's a famous one. And
we can date it, can't we?
Pretty much. It's a warm Sunday evening in late May 1876.
So that's pretty good.
And so I'm probably going to say it's Sunday the 30th of May by the Russian calendar.
You've done a bit of research.
Yeah, so this is, yeah, so it is one of two Sundays.
Okay, so that's a date. Where are we going to?
We are going to a platform on a train station. It's called Obirolovka, or at least it was then, 13 miles east of Moscow. It's not called Obirolovka anymore. In fact, it doesn't really exist anymore. And so we're going to be at the end of a railway station platform. We're going to see a woman throw herself onto the railway tracks. She's a young woman. She's 28 years old. And I think you can probably tell from my voice, I'm finding this extremely, extremely sad, even though she doesn't exist. But she is real to me. And so I'm talking, of course, about Tolstoy's famous heroine, Anna Karenina, with her laughing face and her curls. And I was really shocked when I started to write about this scene. I was trying to reimagine it. And I went to Russia to try and follow Anna's journey to realise actually how young she is in Tolstoy's... In my terms, she's 28, but she's had a husband, two children, a lover, and she's lived this enormous life, but it's far too soon.
So really what we're talking about is standing witness to one of the famous scenes in literary history.
She has, and she was meant to be a warning, a message, a problematic character, but she floats free. She's become reimagined through film and through images into sort of, yes, this something else, something quite other. And I thought it was just to try and imagine what it was like, what this moment might have been like. We can read it in the novel, but there are so many details about this scene, and interesting things happen with time as well. She's left her husband. She's now living with her lover Vronsky, and she's decided that he has in some way fallen out of love with her, and she's trying to work out whether he's going to come back to see her. She's this problems with communications. She sent him a note. He sent her a telegram. She thinks he doesn't care, and she decides to go and find out whether he is actually coming back as early as she wants him to. And she gets on a train, and she gets off the train, receives a note that she misinterprets, and then she's on this platform. And everyone, who else? I was looking very carefully to think, how do we draw this scene? Who else is there? We've got two maid servants making what she perceives are really snotty comments about the lace on her dress, going, oh, it's real. We've got someone selling a sort of Russian beer. We've got people laughing. What, two women waiting for a man in glasses? But all of these people she perceives as being against her. And you can see this sense of absolute terrible mental illness at this moment.
Yeah, it's immediately obvious what attracts you here because of this moment of dramatic consequence from a very long novel. This comes towards the end.
Yes.
The culmination of Anna and Vronsky's relationship.
It isn't the end of the novel, one feels. The novel's called Anna Karenina, you feel it should end, and then it carries on. And there's this sense of actually life carries on, that she has fallen out of the novel, but the world continues. And that sense of, in some way, insignificance. And there's something also slightly that tragicomedy about this moment as well. In some ways, she doesn't set out thinking she's going to kill herself. And there's this extraordinary detail in the scene that people might remember if they've read the book, or might, if I talk about it, help them to conjure it up. As she's thinking, she suddenly decides, I'm going to throw myself on the rails. And she has a little red handbag hanging around her arm. And we've followed Anna, and it's these little details that help us imagine her, her curls, her black velvet dress, and this little red bag that she keeps things in and she fiddles with when she's worried. And it's her sign of maternity, and it's her sign of social, it's her sign of how she pulls herself together and holds herself together. And as she's deciding that she's going to throw herself on the rails, she says she was going to jump between these two carriages, but her little red bag delayed her. And then she throws it aside, and then she jumps. When I first read that scene, and then I read something that Nabokov wrote, he said, what was in Anna Karenina's handbag? And when I read that, I was fascinated because I thought, I too want to know. And it is that those small human details, the way she bends, looks at the track, crosses herself as she did when she was a girl, all her life flashes before her, and that sense of her throwing it aside, and that sense of my fascination in the sense of the interior of her bag and what that might hint about the interior of herself.
You say it's a really tenderly evoked scene from Tolstoy, even though it's a horrific scene at its heart.
This scene has made such an impression on me, and it's so traumatic that it feels like it lasts forever. And it's actually a tiny bit of this novel. Anna's sense of time, life flashing before her, and that sense of how elastic time can be, and also how you can, with the joy of narrative, that you can stretch the telling out or compact it. All those things fascinate me about this scene. And then we've got the train and train time as well.
You note in your book something that Nabokov said, that Tolstoy was the only writer whose watch kept time with the numberless watches of his readers, which was a really fascinating, it reminded me of
something that art historians have said about John Constable. They said he's the only artist whose windmills actually go round the right way. This kind of fidelity to reality, in a way.
That's great.
It's a nice little detail, yeah. Isn't it? But do you want to say something a bit more about this nature of time in Tolstoy's writing?
Yes, because it's kind of right and wrong, because Tolstoy's time is quite wonky in the sense that, as far as, because people have done more work on this, and like the sort of elastic nature of time, he often makes mistakes. Like Kitty, one of the other characters in Anna Karenina, is pregnant, and her pregnancy, she has a 13-month gestation, if you actually track it. And also that Anna and Vronsky's story goes over kind of nearly 4 years, whereas Levin and Kitty's story, which is meant to therefore match, is 3 years. So that's just, it just kind of doesn't work. Not that it really matters, but when you think about how Tolstoy was writing this book, which was full of huge amounts of writer's block and agony, and the point at which he actually just said, well, you just, can someone just finish this book for me? And it was serialized, that you can understand why those continuity errors take place. But maybe it was also that just this, the intensity of Anna and Vronsky's story made it, he needed more time to tell it than the calendar would allow. But in terms of keeping pulse with the watches of his readers, he does, he takes us through the everyday way in which someone sits down at a table and tries to go through a menu and works out what to order, or how someone leaves a house and says, oh God, it's kind of Anna, when she needs her ticket, she opens her bag, she gets her purse out. Those details that make up history in its smallest sense, which fascinates me. This happened, but people have to put their socks on. I love that stuff.
And of course, this scene, as well as standing witness to the tragedy as it's happening, takes us to the railway station, doesn't it? And this idea of trains, which has been so central to your writing in this book, but was a real theme for the characters you write about as well. We got this Tolstoy perspective on trains as an invasive technology.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything about trains and train stations at about this time, or their symbolism in this book?
Trains at this time were dangerous and exciting and passionate. If you find a woman in a 19th century novel reading on a train, that's a big symbol for anyone reading in the 19th century that she's a dangerous woman. She's a fast woman. So there's a culture at the time about train anxiety, about what it would do to the nerves. There are books suggesting that people might get aroused by trains as a, kind of a, in ways that are kind of, you might suffer from illnesses from too much train travel, warning people against train travel. But trains were actually, there were train accidents. The dramatist Boucicault's son was killed in 1876 in a train accident. And so there's sort of the sort of media anxiety about trains, sort of medical evidence or concern about train travel. And then we have actual train accidents. And then we have the fact that with the technology becomes possibility. I mean, you have the novel of bigamy really coming in big time when you have the possibility to have a double life, rather like sort of when that first website like Friends Reunited arrived, people kind of, there was an explosion of affairs, the possibility of what technology does to marriage. But it also very sadly, as we can see, prompts the possibility for people to end their lives. And Anna Karenina's suicide was based on the death by suicide of a woman, a real woman called Anna Pirogova, in 1872, and she was a neighbor of Tolstoy. He lived on a estate, Yasnaya Polyana, and so she lived there, and she threw herself in front of a train in Yasenki station, and Tolstoy went to the autopsy.
And I think this takes us back to one of the things you said right at the beginning of your description of this scene, which is that it's incredibly upsetting to read, even though we are, you know, within the bounds of a novel. And one of the reasons, obviously, is not just because you've gained this relationship with Anna during the course of the reading, is that you know that she's based on various real-life people who we can trace. And that's where we're going to be going later on, to kind of try and find these different dimensions. We'll leave the platform and we'll go to your second scene. Okay. We're still in 1876. Where would you like to go next, please?
Okay, I want to take you now back a few weeks earlier, about a month earlier. We're back in the real world now. Well, kind of in the real world, because I'm taking you to the theatre now. I'm taking you, Peter, to the Gaiety Theatre in London. We can't go there in real life, though, I'm afraid, because they've knocked it down.
Whereabouts was it?
It's on the Strand.
Right in the thick of theatre land.
You can go and sit in a hotel, and I've sat with a floor plan of the old Gaiety Theatre in this hotel, eating a sandwich, trying to feel the spirit of the person I want to take you to meet. We're in the Gaiety Theatre and we are watching a play called The Honeymoon. I told you, it's a very romantic episode, The Honeymoon, except it's not a very romantic play. It's by John Tobin and it's a kind of really vile, toxic, updated version of The Taming of the Shrew. It's all about how you meet a woman and you think she's quite nice, but she's really not subservient enough. And so how do you turn her into a trad wife? How do you kind of make sure she knows that she needs to pour the wine in the right places and just be quiet and put up with it? So the nasty Duke takes his wife-to-be. She thinks she's marrying a nice rich Duke and he actually takes her on honeymoon to this ghastly cottage where she has to do a lot of sort of live in not a very nice way, and then it's only when she's finally crushed that he shows her the palace again.
But I take it that the content of the play isn't why you want to go there.
No, I don't. I want to take you to see that there's a new star on the stage.
Okay, let's cut to her.
Her name is Mary Kemal, and she's it's her debut, and she's causing quite a stir in the character of Volant in The Honeymoon, she's a sister, is a sort of best supporting actress, shall we say. The interesting thing about Mary Kemal is she's actually appearing under a sort of undercover stage name. Her real name is Kate Field.
Right. Kate Field, I know someone who's fascinated you for a while. So I think it's only fair that here we are in the Playhouse.
Yeah.
Theatre's going on, the play is in progress. You can tell me a little bit about the backstory.
Right, so Kate Field, she was a journalist, a lecturer. At this moment, she's an actress, she's a singer. She was a telephone pioneer, and she was the public relations person for the telephone. She founded her own newspaper called Kate Fields Washington. She started a women's clothes cooperative. Feminist, powerful, very, very well connected. In her day, very famous. She started as a teen journalist. I sort of think a bit of her makes me think she might be Catlin Moran, if you want to. But also Kate Adey, because she did foreign correspondence work. Also a bit like Oscar Wilde. She was friends with Dickens and she was a real networker. She was born in America, in Missouri, and her parents were both actors. Her father died when she was 16. He was also a part-time journalist. He was known as Straws. So she took his pen name and wrote under the name Straws Jr. as a teenager. When she was 16, she did the European tour, as all good Americans might. Everyone fell for her, and Walter Savage Landor fell for her so much, he gave her sort of loads of his really early manuscripts and and everyone said, Kate, I think you better give those back. You can't accept those gifts. She hung out with the Brownings. She also caught the eye of one novelist, Anthony Trollope, which is partly also why she became so interesting to me.
Yeah, we're going to follow that thread in a minute. She's a fascinating character. Reading your book, you kind of are always surprised by what she's going to do next. She's one of these people who reinvents and she's always busy. She's got this sense of urgency. I think she's definitely worth going to see. But you also mentioned something quite tantalising there, that she does have connections in Britain, and she has one in particular, doesn't she, which I know you write about in the book. And we're not talking about Tolstoy now, we're talking about another very interesting novelist of the time.
Yes. When she was in Italy, she met Anthony Trollope, the novelist. So what fascinates me about their friendship is how little and how much we can tell about what really happened between them. They wrote to each other throughout, it seems, their life. Kate Field's letters to Trollope don't survive, but his to her, well, some of them have. When Anthony Trollope wrote his memoir, his autobiography, it's a very contained work. He doesn't give much away. He talks about his marriage. He says, well, as for my marriage, it was much like the marriage of other people. You think, well, what are other people's marriages like, Anthony? Tell us more. But he just said, it would be wrong for me not to talk about one person, an American woman, for me to only think of her as to spark a ray of light. He doesn't say her name, but it's quite clear that he's talking about Kate Field. The letters make it clear that they met each other, that sometimes he would call for her, that he would come to her if she gave him word, that they would meet at Niagara, they would go down to the sea together. There are some fictional mentions, some glimpses of riding in a carriage and feeling great excitement with someone. And there's a letter that ends with a kiss that shall be as loving as you like.
There's absolutely enough to tantalise there. And we should just dwell on Trollope as well as a writer for a moment. I know you're a big fan. Mm. I've been talking about preparing for this episode with a few friends over the last few days and saying we're going to be talking about Trollope. And it's surprising how many ardent fans he has today and say, oh, he's so much fun. He's really funny. Just go and read him. He's survived the decades and the centuries quite well, hasn't he? So
yes.
We can maybe leave that to one side because it's a bit tangential to what we're talking about today. But I suppose your contention is that, and it's more than that, there's evidence to back it up, that Kate Field lives quite strongly in his fiction.
Yes, there are numerous Kates in Trollope's novels. They pop up, he uses the name, but also one of the reasons that many people are drawn to Trollope is because he draws wonderfully fallible figures, both male and female, and his strong female characters seem to nod to Kate Field in many, many ways. This sort of sense of his heroines being drawn from the figure of Kate Field. And the sense of people not being able to make their minds up, people kind of wanting to live more than one life at a time, people nearly having an affair runs through the Trollopean narrative. His kind of great title, Can You Forgive Her?, asks us, what do we forgive about a person? What does it mean to feel conflicted, to not be able to sustain one monogamous narrative? And I mean that not just simply not able to stick with some person, but want to have multiple lives. And this is why Tolstoy loved reading Trollope.
And here's the point that we should make the connection, really, because people who've been listening to us talk for the last 20 minutes or so about two very different scenes might be wondering if there's any link which binds the two together. And interestingly enough, there is. I mean, you write, and I'll let you pick up on this, but it's a nice sentence for us to continue with. Parts of Kate Field live on in Anna Karenina is part Kate Field. That's what writers do. They change lives. Can you tell us how this American person of activity, I don't know how to better to describe her than that, can be connected with Tolstoy's great literary character?
Yes. So I spoke earlier about Russian dolls or things being inside other things. We'd left Anna, we'd left her, and we'd left her handbag thrown to one side. Nabokov said, what is in Anna Karenina's handbag? There might be many things in Anna Karenina's handbag. There might be a photo album. There might be the latest contraceptive device. We don't know what's in Anna Karenina's handbag. But we are told very clearly that in Anna Karenina's handbag, there is an English novel. We're even given a little chunk of a description of this English novel. And it's very clear that Tolstoy wants us to imagine that Anna Karenina, his great Russian heroine, is reading a novel by Anthony Trollope. It's not one novel. We can't pin it down, but it seems to be a mixture. And we know that. We can prove it. Tolstoy wrote in his diaries that he said, Trollope kills me with his excellence. And his wife, Sophia, said that whenever Tolstoy sat down to start writing, he started reading English novels. Yes, Dickens, but especially Anthony Trollope. So Tolstoy has given a copy of Trollope. So Anna Karenina, you can imagine she's opening up the Trollope novel, which will be this in some way embedded with a heroine who is based partly on Kate Field. That is how these things wind in and out of each other.
It's a fascinating process of joining dots, isn't it? And so really, if we put it in this imaginary sense, we're there in the playhouse off the Strand. But we could also be seeing a bit of a Anna Karenina as well on the stage. That's this kind of contention that, you know, characters, where do our fictional characters come from? Maybe this is the deep question we're getting to. Is that right?
Yes. So, and I love this idea. So that, so if Kate Field is partly Anna Karenina, if a fictional character is built on something real, but then also is a real person built on something fictional, might we all know, don't we, what it's like to watch a movie or read a book and think, oh, I'll do a bit of that, and how fiction builds us. So the sense of history and fiction, as we talked about in Binning, being very, and I have to imagine my way into a future beyond 1876, where one day Kate Field will sit down and open an American translation of Anna Karenina, and then this will carry on in a sort of infinite regress.
Kate Field's relationship with Trollope,
hmm.
was it just by letter, or might he be sitting there in a playhouse with us?
He absolutely. Trollope could have been sitting to our left watching Kate Field. It would be quite strange if he wasn't. Later on, when you go through things that Kate Field does, you can find guest lists of things she's organising, and you'll find Trollope on that list.
Before we leave entirely Kate Field, I think it's fair that we explain what became of her later on in her life.
Mm.
Is it?
She was always determined to be financially independent. She had a wealthy uncle, but she really had to support, after her father died, she has to support herself and her mother. She was very determined not to get married. She was quite affronted when people told her she could. We know she received at least 2 marriage proposals. "I am swimming alone," she wrote in my diary. She made a lot of money when she realised that the telephone was going to catch on. She organised these sort of special exclusive evenings where she told people about telephone. She wrote a little pamphlet about that. She got Queen Victoria on the other end of the line to try and show her how cool this thing was. She was just very, very good at marketing. She was often sort of riding on a wave. Oh, she went to Charles Dickens's readings and wrote up an account of them, pen portraits of Charles Dickens, went and campaigned for women in Mormon families. She was concerned about multiple marriages, and she did quite a lot of conservation work in America. She was imperfect. She's problematic in many ways. She was satirised in a novel by Henry James, so she has more than one novelist including her. In her later life, she lived with a woman called Lillian Whiting, and some biographers say that as a result, you know, Kate Field was gay. Yes, no, people are many things. We know that she also travelled. She travelled alone. I'm interested in whoever she chose to make her life in, the sense of choosing a single life. And that was what sort of interested me in her narrative, the choosing that road.
Well, it's nice to concentrate on her in one year, because she was so many things, but yes, at least we can see her quite clearly at this moment in 1876. She's equally so, but we won't even get into that, because we've got to go to our third scene. Can you tell us where you'd like to go next, please?
Okay, so we're going back again. So we were in late May, then we went in April, and now I want to take us to March the 17th, 1876, to another person who ghosts through the novel Anna Karenina, and partly Anna Karenina, and she's certainly the model for many thoughts and details, is Sophia Tolstoy, Leo Tolstoy's wife. And on this day, she had just suffered a miscarriage. So I think I'm going to take you to her bedroom and to be with her at this moment, and to think about those moments in history that really don't get written about, that don't make it into history. I suppose we can think about partly the imagined other lives, the lives that would have been, but also women's history and those sort of unwritten stories. She said that she recovered quickly from this miscarriage. She already had 5 children, but she had been very ill the previous year in November. Her baby Varia had died very soon after birth, and so while the retrospection in her autobiography is "I recovered quickly," I'm feeling that on this day that Sophia must be feeling pretty terrible.
You say these moments are quite, well, they're difficult to talk about as well, but they're difficult to find. Where was this documented? In letters, in a diary?
It's documented in her, Sophia Tolstoy's own autobiography. There's quite a lot which, just briefly, I suffered a miscarriage but recovered quickly. The letters around this time document being unwell, and Leo Tolstoy's letters earlier in the November previously talk about being very frightened for her health. It's interesting, actually, that the... And I'm not a Russianist, I should say that. I'm not a Tolstoy expert or a Russianist. I'm, in some ways, this book is a testament to someone who loves a fictional world, but and permission to love a bit of history without needing to know everything about it. But it's quite big on talking about the body, about coughs and colds and breastfeeding, and there's a lot of stuff. It's quite it's comparatively earthly compared to, say, if I was reading Charles Dickens's letters, I don't think I would find that much.
So how much of her do you think seeps into Anna? I mean, you talk about her being an inspiration.
It's things that, ways in which I think Anna is modelled on Sophia, the things like the detail of what Anna wore at the ball, that was actually offered by Sophia. No, she would wear black. She wouldn't be wearing something lightly coloured. It would be much more elegant than that. Mm. That question. But Tolstoy had written earlier a book called Family Happiness, where he basically wrote about the idea that in order to sustain the family idea, you have to give up the romantic. Mm. And it's the sort of the female character in that is finding this very difficult to give up pleasure, joy, excitement, town life, food. And that is really Sophia. She liked all these things. She liked to be pretty, and she liked clothes, and she liked to do many things that Tolstoy definitely disapproved of. So I think that tension is definitely there.
But if we're travelling back in a time-travelling sense, to be there at that moment, in a broader sense, would it be to observe what it would be like in a literary household at that time, being a woman? Is that the nub of the question?
I became really interested as I tried to write a creative work of my own, realising that there was no time to do it, and that what was bothering me and what I was struggling with looked trivial and insignificant. I'm really interested in this person, this woman in 1876, who wanted to have a creative life, and who wanted to have a family, and who wanted to have be a good mother, and how she found it difficult to live in time and space with other people, how she found it difficult to square the demands of herself, the demands of others. And she's writing about the children moving away from her, she's writing about the miscarriage, she's writing the fact that Leo Tolstoy has taken up the piano and is playing really loudly, 4 to 6 times a day, scales and exercises, and it's driving her mad. And that sense, I became fascinated. I read a book by Roland Barthes called How to Live Together. It sounds like one of those marvellous how-to guides, I thought. And that was what I was sort of struggling with at the time, of kind of young children, husband. How do we intersect our various... How do we travel through time together with other people? How do we do it in a civilised way that respects our autonomy and integrity? And I was just fascinated to find Sophia having these, just basically, like, I'd quite like to escape from you. It would be better to be anywhere but in these hateful Yasnaya Polyana walls, she wrote to her sister around this time. And it's not helped by the fact that, so firstly, he's playing the sodding piano non-stop. He's not writing Anna Karenina, which he needs to be writing. He's got completely blocked. And he's having a religious transformation. And he's talking about wanting to hang himself from the rafters. And Sophia is copying out bits and contributing. She's central to its happening. And in fact, he's writing about the family life. He's taking these details and this existence from and placing it in the text. And actually, those little details, I sound obsessed with this bag, but I do. I'm interested in that sense of holding everything together. I went to Yasnaya Polyana to try and understand Leo Tolstoy, and I realised that I wasn't really thinking, as I was wandering around, I was thinking about how was his writing process? How did he manage to write with a big family? And I completely ignored Sophia as I wandered around the house. my friend was pointing out, she said, you should look at, here are Sophia's photographs, and she decorated this room. I realised that I was, when I got back, I'd overlooked the history of this person. It was only when I got back to England, I thought, I'm fascinated by her. When I went to the estate, I said to them, I'm looking for Anna Karenina's handbag, and they looked at me like I was slightly insane, because obviously she's fictional, but I said, do you think Sophia would have had a bag? I would like to know what this bag might look like. The house was closing and the archivist said it would be difficult to find because everything in Yasna Apollyonova is preserved in the place it was when Leo Tolstoy died,
so
give
it's
or take.
Fossilised.
Yeah, but then it's embedded. It's not as if there's a display case. And then she walked in and the sun was falling. It was nearly dark and then kind of in the last 5 minutes with a little red bag.
Wow.
For me to look at. And it was Sophia's handmade bag. She was a great, you know, is sort of... And I held that bag and I thought, this is where this fact and this fiction collides. But also what struck me so tenderly was the idea of this different kind of creativity, the craft that had gone into making this object, which I love to see.
So it's almost a dovetailing of material history and literary history there, because you get the object out of the novel, perhaps, as we can speculate, arriving in a room where you're standing many years later. But of course you're back in this room now. So we've explored it from all sorts of different angles. What I think you've given us today in the course of this conversation is something which is completely non-linear, which is really nice. It's a bit challenging maybe for our format. But it's hugely absorbing and fascinating to follow these links and where they take you. Putting two things together that you wouldn't readily do. Mm. And finding a new truth and the kind of Venn diagram of overlapping. Do you see what I mean?
I do. I mean, Henry James said that sort of the Victorian novel, he kind of didn't, the baggy monster. And I just love, I love the capaciousness of what good history and good fiction can do to time. But I think I stand by the fact that the capaciousness it has to be recognised, of the elasticity of it all and the porousness of our novels and our history and our works of art and how they merge with each other.
I think so. Well, just as I was coming out today, I was looking through an almanac from the 1770s. And I,
as you do.
As I was, you know, walking out the door, as I do. Maybe that quite wasn't how it was. But anyway, let me frame that. But there's a verse about time which I thought was appropriate for today. And it says, time like a stream that hastens from the shore, flies to the ocean where 'tis known no more. And it's this idea of the fluid passing of events. And I was trying to put some framework of our own understanding on them. It's always fascinating to think about the nature of time. And I think in your book, you do that really provocatively and quite beautifully as well sometimes. I've got one last question to you, though, before I let you escape. If you could take one memento back from this year, 1876, what would you like to have?
Well, because I've loved listening to these podcasts, I kind of thought this question was going to come. So I was thinking about it. And so in some ways I thought, would it be Sophia's handbag? But actually, in the course of thinking about writing this kind of history and forgotten stories, one of the things that I found myself doing was going through a lot of the classified ads in the front pages of the Times.
And there's some brilliant ones.
And there's some brilliant ones. So if I can have a memento, and I've brought it here, it's the classified ads for Tuesday, June the 13th, 1876. So that, I've chosen that date because it is, in English terms, if I'm right, the day Anna Karenina died. So it's the Times for the day Anna Karenina died because it's ahead of the Russian calendar. And it's also my late father's birthday, which I found by coincidence. And I think that's one of those lovely things.
It is. It's
about
nice
history. Is what, the reason we go somewhere in history is often quite personal, or we can make things personal. So this is my dad's birthday, but in 1876. And what, if you've never seen one of these classified ads before in the Times, it's tiny little columns, it's fascinating things. And I think it's rather lovely, if we're having this on Valentine's Day, that the very first entry, because it starts with A, is A to C, Someone has placed this ad, someone called A, to someone called C. A to C, it is needless to say I miss you and that you have every possible loving good wish. I'm happy to think the time will not be too long before I shall see you again. I should like to know all's well. Goodbye. I would like to know what happened there. Is it? It feels sort of something so plangent about this little story. And the next one down is someone trying to trace a lady who courageously stopped a runaway horse. And they want to thank her.
Well, this is what, I mean, reading old newspapers is one of the best things to do anyway. They say journalism's the first draft of history, I think.
Mm.
And here you just get this, like, kind of real raw take on life. It's very immediate, isn't it?
It's wonderful. Lots of things, kind of lost dogs. I found lost hot air balloons.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we give you the clipping of the newspaper for that day?
I can have the front page.
And then you, what you can do is when you're writing about Tolstoy or his wife or Miss Field, you can glance up from your desk and wonder what was happening with all of these people in 1876. How about that?
Everyone is a novel in miniature.
Well, there we go. Thank you very, very much, Sophie. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
That was me, Peter Moore, talking to Dr. Sophie Ratcliffe in her office at Lady Margaret Hall, Oxford, the other day. Sophie's book absolutely grabbed me, and I can happily recommend it to you all. The Lost Properties of Love is published in paperback this week. Next Tuesday, we're going to be back with another Travels Through Time, and this is going to be a brilliant tour to the year 415, a conversation with Violet Moller and the author of The Darkening Age, Catherine Nixie. Here you can listen to a little bit of a snippet from their conversation.
Texts in this period are not very good at describing what the common man thought, but it's clear that the people of Alexandria are the ones who protect Orestes. So there's some sort of movement among the locals, and he escapes, the monks disperse, and the feud between him and Cyril gets even deeper.
So plenty to look forward to there. Thanks again for listening to us today for our Valentine's Day special. Enjoy the weekend. We'll see you soon. Goodbye.